KZSU-FM Stamford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet Society at Stamford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm excited to have on Amar Singh, who is the Director of Programs for the Sikh Coalition. The Sikh Coalition is an organization that Amar is a co-founder of that represents the Sikh community here in the United States. And, of course, the Sikh community is one that has received recent media attention based upon the terrorist attacks that occurred a few months ago. And so we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about those issues, but more broadly talking about some of the issues that relate to both primarily technology that Amar focuses on, things like cyberbullying and privacy and respect and airport screening and policing and portrayals of Sikhs in the media. On occasion on Hearsay Culture, I've had the opportunity to have on individuals who focus on a variety of discussion with one of the leaders in the Sikh community on a variety of these issues. And so I'm very excited to have Amar on the show. We are recording the show in a slightly unusual format for Hearsay Culture. That is that Amar is actually on a cell phone in Washington, D.C. Despite that limitation, I think we'll be able to have a good discussion, and I'm looking forward to chatting with Amar on these issues. By way of background, Amar is the co-founder of the Sikh Coalition, which is the largest civil rights organization in the United States, representing the Sikh community. He serves as director of programs, where he oversees the use of litigation, advocacy, and community organizing to advance their goals. He has represented dozens of Sikh victims in airport profiling, employment discrimination, and hate crimes since the organization's inception after 9/11. He helped formulate guidelines governing the searches of Sikh passengers in U.S. airports. He's also worked on a variety of issues in the city of New York, where the Sikh Coalition is based. By way of a personal note, Amar is a 1997 graduate of Case Western Law School, where I graduated from in 1998, and so I do know Amar from law school. In addition, he is also someone that I ran into when I was working for the City of New York in Corp Counsel's office, where the Sikh Coalition was involved in issues involving the wearing of Sikh headdresses by traffic officers in New York City and the issues around that. So I've stayed in touch with Amar since law school, but I'm very excited to have him on the show today discussing these issues. Amar, thank you for taking time out of your very busy schedule to hang out on a cell phone in Washington and join us today on Hearsay Culture.
Thanks so much for having me on the show, Dave. I really look forward to reconnecting from our law school days and talking to your listeners.
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm excited to do this as well, Amar. Let's start off with some background. And before I even ask you about the Sikh Coalition, why don't you talk a little bit about your background and why you became interested in representing really the Sikh community and focusing on the issues that you do?
I was born and raised in this country. I really wasn't aware of anything having to do with civil or human rights until what I would say would be the late 80s, early 90s. There was a lot of unrest in India where my family's been from, involving the Sikh community. Members of our congregation were coming to New Jersey, where I'm from, and, they had really horrible tales of being tortured in the state of Punjab, where most Sikhs come from in India. And that really moved me. Their stories still stay with me. And I developed an interest in high school in human rights issues. Consistent with that, after law school, I ended up deciding to go try to get my LLM in international law with the intention of working in international human rights. In the middle of my LLM, 9/11 occurred. I ended up taking a leave of absence, and instead of focusing on international human rights issues for my career, I ended up working on domestic civil rights issues involving my community. But that's basically my path to sort of where I am as I speak to you now.
So the Sick Coalition that you're a co-founder of was born out of 9/11. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about that, and then more about the coalition and its primary focuses.
Sure, no problem. You know, you're 100% right. The coalition was born on the night of 9/11. Me and a group of young sort of professional volunteers put out a press release the night of 9/11. Condemning the attack on our country and calling on the police to protect our community from hate crimes in New York and New Jersey. We'd already received reports on the afternoon of 9/11 of a Sikh house of worship, it's called a Gurdwara, being vandalized in Richmond Hill, Queens. A Sikh elderly gentleman being beat up with a baseball bat, again in Richmond Hill, Queens, and people in New Jersey getting verbally harassed on the street. Another person was almost sideswiped off the road. And so, it all happened very quickly. It's the day of 9/11. And so we issued a press release and basically spent the next month documenting what had happened. By the second day after 9/11, we created a website where people could report incidents of bias. And I would literally then spend... I had a computer next to my bed, and I would sort of work on the computer, use the fax, use the phone to call local police jurisdictions, call the media, go to sleep, wake up next to my computer, keep working through the day. And, you know, that first night, month after 9/11, we documented over 300 incidents of either job discrimination, people not being allowed to even just fly, if they wanted to wear their turban, obviously, violent hate crimes, including the murder of Bulbir Singh Sodhi on September 15th in Mesa, Arizona, by someone who said he was killing a terrorist. And, as you can imagine, all sorts of incidents of school bullying and harassment. So it was, that's basically what the coalition was born of. It was born of out of a, very unfortunate tragedy on our country that was, sadly compounded by attacks on fellow Sikh American citizens.
Now, and I will ask you a few basic questions about Sikhism in a moment, but to talk about the coalition a little bit more, you are now no longer volunteers, from what I can tell, and you're doing quite a bit these days. Why don't you tell us a little bit?
Yeah, we've obviously built some infrastructure. I became a first full-time staff member after a stint at Human Rights Watch in September 2003. We now have 10 full-time staff members in 3 different offices. One office is in our base in New York. We have another office in D.C. and then a office in the Bay Area in California, and where there's a huge Sikh population. And we have staffed up 4 program areas. The first is the legal program, which I would really characterize as firefighting. If someone's fired, if someone's bullied at school, if someone's profiled at an airport, we'll come in and try to use the law as a means of remedying that wrong. The next program area is advocacy. We'll work to create rules that are respectful of people's rights. The signature campaign recent victory in that regard would be a change in the law in California signed by Governor Jerry Brown that has a heightened standard for employers before they reject or request for religious accommodation. We've seen issues with Sikhs being told, you can have a job with equal pay and benefits, but if you're in a public service situation, you can't be visible because your turban's out of our uniform policy, so we'll just make you work in the back where nobody can see you, which, as you can imagine, is problematic for, in terms of opportunities, promotion. It's, arguably a system of segregation. And so, California passed a law that says that employers, rather than having what is under, was usually under the law in California, but also federally, they have to show a de minimis cost or a minimal cost or burden before rejecting a request for a religious accommodation, now need to show a significant difficulty or expense, which is obviously a wide difference between a de minimis burden and a significant difficulty or expense. If you reject a request for religious accommodation, it's our hope that this change in the standard will keep employers' eyes squarely on whether an employee can do their job or not, and nothing else. So that's the ADSI program. We're trying to create rules that are friendly towards freedom and the like. And then next is our education program. That is really long-term work. It's work to create a world where Sikhs are viewed for what we bring to the table, what we do for our neighborhoods, what we do for our schools, what we do for our country, you know, nothing else. So that when somebody sees me, rather than seeing, you know, turban equals terrorist, they'll see someone who was, you know, born and raised in New Jersey, you know, my mom was a soccer mom, played Little League baseball, I'm a diehard New York Yankees fan, you know, sorry, Giants fan, so I'm an American, you know, period. That's the education program. It's long-term work. You know, we've really just begun staffing up there and, you know, have had some significant victories. You know, the one I would point out in that regard is the state of Texas, which most of the countries base their textbooks on, their curriculum standards, just agreed to include mandatory information on the sort of six, on who's six and who they are and their contributions to the country. As part of the sort of social studies curriculum where people, where kids, students learn about, you know, all faiths, you know, around the world. It's part of sort of general world awareness curriculum that's mandatory in Texas. But it's obviously going to influence what's in textbooks, which, you know, we view as a very positive development in terms of our education work. And then finally is community organizing, which is giving community a platform with which to defend their rights so that, you know, people like me who have, you know, an elite education, a graduate degree, aren't the sole folks who have, you know, agency or a say in the community's rights, but the grassroots community has a meaningful way to engage them. That's our community organizing program. It's those four program areas that we use in various combinations in order to hopefully produce social justice.
Now, your current the organization structure at this point. How many people do you have working for you, and what are the basic staffing? Before we talk a few minutes about Sikhism as a religion and get into some of the issues.
Yeah, absolutely. So, basically, I have under me all four of our program areas. There are two attorneys in the legal program who report to me. There are two advocates, one in D.C. and one in the Bay Area, who report to me. There's an education director, and then there are two organizers on both coasts who are programmatic reports, who report to me. And then the rest of the organization, we have an executive director who generally runs the organization, takes care of, obviously, you know, making sure I'm doing my job in terms of program direction, but then also is, you know, administration, fundraising is tend to be more of the focus on our executive director's end, and then we have a development person and a comms communication person.
The Sikh community, as I mentioned in the introduction, of course, has gotten much more attention recently because of the terrorist attacks in Wisconsin. But tell us in a few minutes. I recognize this is a question that could take the rest of the interview about the core tenets of Sikhism and perhaps very briefly about its background and founding.
Yeah, you know, the core tenets are pretty simple. You know, I would say that Sikhism is a monotheistic faith, you know, believes that there is one God that loves and sustains all of humanity. There are three core principles by which we're supposed to lead our daily life. First one is called Kirt Kamai in Punjabi, our native language, which means to work hard and honestly. So no matter what job you do, whether you work at a Subway franchise, or you're a lawyer like me, or you're a school teacher or a police officer, the idea is, as my uncle would say, your work is your worship. If you're working hard and you're working honestly, you're honoring the Creator. The second principle is called Vanchakna, which is the idea that you share your bounty with those in your community who are in need. And then the third, the daily principle by which we're supposed to live our lives, is called Namjapana, which is the idea of always remembering God in the back of your mind in whatever you do. So, for example, as I'm talking to you, somewhere in the back of my mind, I'm supposed to be mindful of the Creator. So those are the three, you know, principles including Christianity and the Abrahamic traditions. There's seven deadly sins. We have five sins. I think all five overlap. Greed, anger, lust, ego, and I'm forgetting the last, the fifth one, but it's you know, very similar to what's in the Abrahamic traditions. And then I think the thing that we get asked about the most is the turban.
Yes.
And our unshorn hair. And so the turban, really, the best way to explain it is a physical manifestation of our inner beliefs. And the idea is that by physically manifesting our beliefs, and Six are supposed to wear five articles of faith, one of which is the turban, that these say to the rest of society, but also to ourselves, that we're bound to live by the three principles I enunciated. We're bound to live an honest and a decent life. So the idea is, well, you know, hey, I might not be nice to someone at work, and you know, they'll remember here that I'm wearing a turban, or I might do stuff that's much worse. But you know, this turban is literally sitting on my head as a physical reminder that I've, you know, agreed at least in principle to be a good person and an honest person and a giving person and a loving person. It's very similar in a way that I always say to a law enforcement officer, that a law enforcement officer's uniform, it's held so sacred because it's supposed to encapsulate and protect a society that I, as a police officer, supposed to do good. Is it a guarantee that I'm going to do good? Absolutely not. Does it make it more likely that I'll do good once I put on the uniform, wear the shield? Absolutely. And I think it's the same case with the Sikh uniform. It's this just reminder of who we're supposed to be. As a practical matter, the turban does keep our hair, which is unshorn, long and neat. People do ask about the unshorn hair as well, and the idea behind our unshorn hair is that it's a gift from our Creator that we don't give up, and so we try to maintain our natural state as God gave it to us. And the turban, as a practical matter, keeps our hair, you know, neat and tidy. So, but that's basically it, I think, in a nutshell, between the core beliefs and how our physical appearance manifests those beliefs.
We're chatting with Amar Singh, co-founder of the Sikh Coalition, KZSU-FM, Stanford, and Hearsay Culture. Amar, last quick demographic question. You referred to a little bit earlier in terms of numbers. How big is the community? You mentioned the community is largely in New York and California, but what numbers do you have?
So the Sikh community is, you're absolutely right, mostly on both coasts. The original Sikh community came to California, the Central Valley, and in fact, and were farmers, much like they are in Punjab. I had the pleasure, actually, this past weekend of being in Stockton, California, where the first Sikh Gurdwara, or house of worship, was built. It was the 100-year anniversary of that Gurdwara, the first Sikh Gurdwara in the United States. And so I was in Stockton, California for that. In terms of numbers, the estimates range from about 280,000 to 600,000 members of our community. The Decennial Census doesn't take information by religion, so you know, the numbers are definitely estimates. We've been a hedge on the lower end for 300,000.
So as we let's get into some of the issues, Amar, before we take our first break in a few minutes. And the first one I want to talk about is one you referred to a short while ago with regard to the turbans, is cyberbullying. And that's something that cyberbullying is something that, of course, is gaining prominence, particularly with the explosion of social media. Talk to us initially about what current examples you're seeing of cyberbullying in the Sikh community.
Well, I think there's definitely garden variety cyberbullying where people are harassed on Facebook, negative posts are put against them, casting aspersions on their religious appearance, being the turban and the beard, or trying to make a connection to them and terrorism and the like. But then, you know, I think what's even more troubling, or well, maybe I shouldn't wait them and just say it's troubling, but is the creation of multiple Facebook groups that cast aspersions on just the whole Sikh community. And again, our articles of faith and or, you know, a purported connection to terrorism is that the Church of Beer does often mistakenly associated with terrorism as it applies to Sikhs. And so that's basically what the universe looks like. There's just current Friday cyberbullying where young people through social media, cell phone, text messages, like, are harassed, but then because of their, you know, their faith and their national origin. And then there's the creation of these groups, these Facebook groups that are, you know, just predicated on hating people who wear turbans.
Now, when you receive a report of cyberbullying, what is your organization's reactions? What are the steps that you take in order to counter it or address it?
I think, you know, first we make clear to the potential client that you know, the legal protections in terms of, you know, the First Amendment, the ability to freely express your hate or aspersions on a person or a community are, you know, remain intact in the country. And, you know, what we're trying to do is usually parse out whether the language that is used via text or Facebook or email is threatening in any way, physically threatening, in which case, you know, the law could provide some remedy. We'll also, to the extent that it's connected to school, advise the person that they, you know, they'll allow us, you know, we should perhaps contact the school to see if there's a way of, you know, intervening, you know, keeping in mind, again, that, you know, there are First Amendment protections involved. But, you know, cyberbullying is a bit of a challenging issue to address because, you know, the law doesn't really provide for a sanction, you know, it's not much sanction, it's really more of a hearts and minds issue that we're, you know, trying to address, you know, to be honest, with a very varied degree of success.
And you know, one of the issues that comes up generally whenever cyberbullying or other issues involving information intermediaries arise is the fact that entities like Facebook and Twitter and others are largely immune from claims like defamation because of Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. I'm curious if your organization or if you have made any efforts towards addressing these issues by contacting or working with social media sites.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, there was I'm also part of a commission appointed by President Obama, called the White House Commission on Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. We've gotten a hold of good federal data showing that the Asian American and Pacific Islander community has the highest rates of bullying in the country as compared to other racial groups. And so we convened a summit on the issue. At the summit, we invited representatives of Facebook and MTV, and I'll tell you, Dave, it was so interesting. There was a very pointed discussion with a Facebook representative who presented Facebook's app to combat cyberbullying, and, you know, the six in the audience that said, look, you know, there are all these hate groups where, you know, the people are, like, saying, you know, like, if you hate turbans and the like, and so, there was a very pointed question to the Facebook representative as to why do these exist? How do we get rid of them? And, you know, her response was, we receive enough of a volume of complaints about a Facebook group, we will, you know, see whether it's within our rules, and then we'll eliminate it if it is. But the message was, you know, complain about it enough, and we'll look at it and possibly take it down. And, you know, part of the pushback was, look, you're a private site, you can post up or allowed to have posted anything you want. There needs to be some sort of expedited process outside of your normal process for, you know, Facebook groups that could lead to, you know, racial or religious animus, could lead to bullying, you know, affecting children and the like. So that's basically how we've engaged Facebook. And then since then we have, you know, worked to get site taken down and that one site was taken down.
With regard to that particular site, can you tell us anything about it in terms of what it was that had crossed the line, as it were, for Facebook to take an action which is highly unusual for them?
Yeah, it was just, you know, a site that basically said, like, if you, you know, hate turbans, you know, that sort of thing, and had a, you know, picture of a sick. Mm-hmm. And so, that, you know, got taken down, so I believe another site went up that was very similar.
Right.
And still has it been taken down. So, you know, this remains a problem. You know, Facebook is a private entity. Their site does affect people's perceptions, and, you know, we don't think they're being responsible corporate citizens yet.
And that's kind of what I want to ask you. And you know, again, I mean, you are an attorney, although you're not a technologist specialist or an IP specialist. So, but I'll ask you a question anyway, because I'm curious to get your perspective on it. Yeah, I mentioned Section 230, and Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, as you know, says effectively that information intermediaries that are not acting as publishers, or actually not acting as speakers, excuse me, are not going to be held liable for a variety of actions, including defamation. And the general defense of that statute is that in the absence of that kind of protection, these websites wouldn't exist, and they wouldn't be willing to expose themselves to the kinds of claims that would happen every time someone says something on a media site, for example, that someone else doesn't like. But of course, that policy has enormous costs, and so I'm curious of your perspective, if you have one, on the state of the law generally in shielding entities like Facebook and Twitter's and others from defamation actions, and ultimately, you know, from responsibility, at least from a legal perspective, from variety of claims that would directly sound like cyberbullying.
You know, the question you pose on the budget poses really your classic law and policy question that I can imagine a law school professor like yourself posing to their students as to what's the right balance between the need for encouraging innovation, but in this case, preventing something, you know, that's a force to society's values, too, in terms of expression of racial or religious or national origin type of animus.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I would say that where I sit, given the number of suicide, you know, that we've seen, you know, by young teens when it comes to cyberbullying, I think it really gives me pause and makes me think that maybe we need to rethink the balance. You know, one of the things that I find most poignant when I go to various conferences on school bullying and how to prevent it is that the thing that's been said about cyberbullying is that, look, you know, growing up before this technology existed, you got bullied at school, you went home, it was a safe space, you went back to school, you might be bullied, but you always had your home as a safe space. With technology, that's just not the case. There is no space. It stays with you. It gnaws at you wherever you are. Until, you know, unfortunately, as we've seen over the last you know, few years, there have been some, you know, very significant high-profile suicides, you know, where people have you know, talked about killing themselves as a result of, you know, how they're being bullied, you know, people encouraging, you know, the person to commit suicide, and then it actually happening. You know, I would argue that, you know, these are value choices, you know, that society's making, and I hope more attention is put to the issue so that people can squarely ask themselves, you know, do we have the right balance? At what cost is the need for innovation coming?
We're chatting with Amar Singh, a co-founder of the Sick Coalition on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you who listen to the show regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University, which relies on donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways to make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. ksasu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our webpage at ksasu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you continue to listen to the show. So, Amr, yeah, I mean, you know, that is an enormous cost, as you mentioned. And you know, the cases in the field all talk about these scenarios where, and again, one of these information intermediaries, Facebook, AOL, so forth, just simply didn't do anything at all in response to actions that led not only to loss of life, but also, of course, less extreme loss of business and reputation and so forth. In your conversations with Facebook, have you found them? You mentioned that they have occasionally acted, but that you think they're not there yet. In terms of what next steps you'd like to see entities like Facebook and others take, what would they be?
I would imagine that in cases where particularly young people are involved and there's bullying that can lead to anywhere to, literally has been documented death by suicide or lesser forms of, degradation, that there be a, defined process to address those matters, meaning gay or nay, the stuff, the content remain in an expedited manner, and Facebook should, outside of its normal process, that they prioritize issues of cyberbullying. Facebook has created an app where you, make a pledge against cyberbullying, but that's really not enough. It's sort of what I would say is that it's a nice gesture, but it's really not addressing the issue of the harassment that is rampant on that site of children or in this case of six, whole community. Again, as I said, the good corporate citizen, I believe this is, their responsibility. Given the opportunity to have this platform, they should use it appropriately. And so I would argue that even though it's a cost to better police their site, their private site, they should bear that cost.
Are there any?
And by the way, sorry.
Oh yeah, sorry. Please, yeah.
We should consider whether the law should force that choice on them.
Yeah, and I mean. Yes, and that's an issue that has come up. Obviously, cyberbullying is only one, although a primary example of how these technologies can be used in bad ways. There have been other scenarios involving things like rape, where liability didn't extend. Last question on this point, or before we turn to privacy and security issues with regard to police and airport screening, are there any companies, in your view, that are doing a better job than Facebook in dealing with these issues?
No. Facebook has really been at the epicenter of this ongoing colloquy. And, as I've said, they're just not where they need to be. And at the end of the day, I have it'll be different 5 years from now, but they're the standard bearer. And how they address this issue, I think will have a significant impact on how companies later on might or might not address it, and where the law and policy might end up.
Amr, let's turn to privacy and respect in police screening. So, yet again, the Turban plays an enormous role here. What is the state of affairs with regard to the kinds of screening and profiling issues that the SIC community's faced over the last 10-plus years?
Yeah, so, basically there's been a significant, I would say, evolution in screening technology, combined with an evolution of an understanding of the nature of the threats facing our country, which means that between the evolving nature of the threat and the evolving state of technology, how people, and in this case the community, is screened at the airport has evolved. So I'll give you a brief history. Right after 9/11, six were being told, the security tank saw Kutcherbin, or he used to can't port the spike so we could search it. And obviously, you know, for stick signature, but all been the kitten to a strip search. It's, well, it's an integral part of our body. We don't leave our, you know, homes with our heads left covered. And so, you know, you can also mention at the time there was no TSA, there was just Department of Transportation and the federal, aviation. Why am I forgetting the acronym?
TSA?
You know, no, before the TSA, there was the Federal Aviation Administration.
No, the FAA. I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah.
And so they really controlled screening, and it was a combination of a public and private entities. And what ended up happening was, you know, about 2 months after 9/11, we ended up having a significant meeting with the Secretary of the Department of Transportation, Secretary Norman Edda. He himself had been interned after World War II. He's a Japanese American, so he, you know, very understood in a personal way the sort of intersection between national security and civil rights and technology and the like. And so he, one of them happened was the nature of the threat at the time that they were really looking for metallic threat items. And so we've come to an agreement with the DOT at the time, there's no TSA, that a particular, they go through a metal detector and there's no beep, that they shouldn't be secondarily screened. If they went through a metal detector and there's a beep, and they're then wanded, if the wand beeps over the turbine, but only over the turbine, then there should be a request that the turbine be patted down, and then after the turbine is patted down by an officer, a screening officer, if there's a, you know, belief that there's something dangerous in there, or if they can't confirm that something dangerous is, you know, in the turbine or underneath the turbine, then, you know, there would be a screening of the turbine itself done, you know, in a private area, out of public view. And so that was the agreement, and it held fast until until 2007. And in 2007, the TSA, which now existed, had come to the conclusion that in addition to metallic threat items, there were non-metallic threat items that could be put together to create and to provide explosive bites and IED. And so the TSA started screening for non-metallic items. The problem was that there was no mechanism to do so, so they instituted a mandatory turbine search rule. Now that grew the stick community into, you know, concerns, saying, you know, hey, my turbine, you know, is a piece of cloth that actually can't hide what you say you're looking for in terms of an IED any more than, you know, like the cuff of my pants or a summer dress, and the like, so this seems like discrimination. So the policy then changed again, at this time, and it's basically the current policy that remains in place to this day. The TSA will not engage in secondary screening unless a person is wearing what is called bulky clothing, which is or non-form-fitting clothing, which is on its face neutral as to religion. What happens in practice, though, is that at some airports, it ends up being secondarily screened, you know, like 100% of the time. And the issue that people have with it is that, you know, again, you know, other parts of the body, people's clothing is just as capable of hiding potential non-metallic threat items, IEDs and the like, that could create an IED that the TSA is looking for. So I think that's, I know, a long explanation, but that's basically how, between technology and what they're looking for, and law and policies, you know, what's happened at the screen checkpoint as it evolves, fixes, it really evolved.
It sounds to me, but correct me if I'm wrong, that the technology has been, as far as you're concerned, an unadulterated good development in reducing the kinds of profiling that Sikhs have been running into. Is that correct?
You know, the technology is not totally there yet. I mean, in an ideal scenario, what you want is equalized screening. And so we've been told, but it hasn't happened yet, that, you know, the TSA's real goal is to have technology that can identify metallic and non-metallic threat items without any extra screening. Meaning, you know, it's same machine that I walk through, and it, whether I'm wearing a turban or not, and it has the same capabilities that identify threat items. And you should keep in mind that when before the new advanced imaging technology machines were introduced by the TSA about 2 years ago, and are slowly being rolled out throughout the country, that these are the machines where you walk in and you keep your hands up, and there's some quick pumps of air, and it's supposed to identify basically chemical residue. Again, that could be used to make an IED. We were told that that machine would effectively eliminate the need for secondary screening of six, and it would actually equalize screening, and we really welcomed it. What ended up happening, however, once the machines were put in the field, it was found that they had trouble seeing through the folds of the fabrics of six. And instead of guaranteeing that six would be secondarily screened, now when you go through those machines, and I just went through one this past weekend, you are mandatorily secondarily screened, which means that you pat down your own turban on it. They swipe your hands with a swab that might detect a trace chemical. And so sort of the ill that we see of being secondarily screened, the turban being targeted, people being afraid of the turban because they can see our government secondarily screening the thing that people are, afraid of. The technology in this case, though it promised to eliminate the issues, actually made it worse. It is where it is.
Let's and we're chatting with Umar Singh of the Sick Coalition on KZCFM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Umar, I know you're on a tight schedule, and we have about 10 minutes left, but I do want to take up the last topic that I mentioned in the introduction, which is the portrayals of Sikhs in the media. So where does that issue stand as well?
Rather than getting better, the problem of the turban in the public mind equaling terrorists has gotten, much, much worse. The truth is that 99% of the people, who wear turbans in our country are members of the community. We have nothing to do with Taliban. There's nothing to do with Bin Laden. In fact, historically speaking, we've been fighting the Taliban and their ancestors for much longer than our government has. But because the predominant image that people see when I go to a law enforcement setting or a school setting and I'm giving a presentation, the first question I'll ask is, when you see a turban, what do you think of? And the answer is always terrorists. And so that image has gotten worse since 9/11. It's the number one image you see on TV when you see a turban and a beard like I'm wearing now is that of a terrorist. And so things are really bad. Things are really bad. And in a, in a media cycle that is, for profit, needs to convey information quickly to keep people's eyeballs on the screen and needs to, project information that, people care about, people learning about who Sikhs are, and getting that first story that's ripped a beard might as well have, thrown up in New Jersey and plays fantasy football like me. That's just not going to be conveyed.
Go ahead. Oh no. So I was going to ask as a follow up: is there any evidence that you have that that with regard to these perceptions that the ability of the Sikh community to use the same technology that everyone else does to get the word out is having any effect on the general population? In other words, to the extent that a website or a blog or social media or what have you is effective to counter these perceptions, has your organization used that technology and to what effect?
Dave, the honest answer to that is not really, and I think it's because our efforts have been, fairly under-resourced in this regard. I believe there's a potential with social media, for sure. For example, after an activist, the disorderly, with regard to the response, the worshippers, You know, there's been something called the Be Proud movement, which encourages people to be proud of who they are. And, you know, that movement has over 24,000 followers on Twitter now, over 100,000, you know, likes on Facebook. But it's really a nation effort, and I care for our nation, and we haven't utilized social media to its fullest potential. Yeah, with regard to social media, I would say that our effort to get the word out on our community is, you know, relatively new. You know, I would say social media is something that we've underutilized. After the murders in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, 2 months ago, where six members of our community were shot down by a neo-Nazi in the Kurgelar, this accounts of worship there. There's something called the Be Proud Movement, which encourages people to just be proud of their heritage. That has over 24,000 followers on Twitter and over 100,000 likes on Facebook in the span of, you know, only 2 months. But, you know, outside of that, I would say, you know, the use of social media has been relatively underutilized or untapped. I would say, though, that at the end of the day, social media, I don't think it's going to be the end-all and be-all, you know, when it comes to educating people as to our humanity and our contributions to our country. You know, what the research has shown over and over again is that if somebody knows a Sikh in their personal life, and they know a Muslim in lots of, you know, misperceptions and stereotypes, they're much more likely to not have those misperceptions and stereotypes. They have to personally know someone. And so, absolutely, you know, social media is important for sort of affirming values. But I think the real learning comes in, you know, face-to-face, old-fashioned relationships, like we had in law school.
I was about to say, you know, that there's a raging debate, and it's only going to increase within the educational world about the use of online resources and online courses and basically teaching through the internet. And that, you know, that issue is far from resolved, and the benefits and drawbacks are still being assessed. Umar, in the last couple of minutes we have, I do want to give you opportunity to the extent that, you know, you have an audience here made up primarily of people in the technology and or intellectual property fields, but focusing on technology and in talking to that community, what message would you like to leave with that community? What would you like to see come out of that community that would address the concerns that we discussed today with regard to the Sikh community?
I would say, you know, not just the Sikh community, more broadly on the issue of civil rights. I think the power of technology to mobilize people is relatively untapped. We do know that, of course, that, you know, that, for example, the Arab Spring was greatly facilitated through the use of Facebook and Twitter, and that, you know, the Arab Spring just started with a Facebook event. But I would say, in other ways, technology has been underutilized when it comes to civil rights. You know, just an example, around the Sikh community, that we issued a phone application in April, where, you know, people would be able to quickly report instantly what they believe is deprofiling directly with the TSA, and we work with the TSA, and they consider those complaints from the phone app to be official complaints. And I'll tell you, Dave, you know, since April, we have quadrupled the number of complaints that the TSA has had to investigate as a result of the app, and I think it's a good use of technology to make people's voices heard. But I think, you know, we're just scratching the surface there, and there's a real potential for something like a phone to be a, you know, civil rights Swiss Army knife, if we so, you know, try to work to move in that direction, you know, using technology. So I think, you know, technology, like anything else, is a double-edged sword. In the case of cyberbullying, it could be used to undermine civil rights, but, you know, in the case of our phone app, it can be used to promote civil rights. Of course, I'm always going to hope it'll be the latter.
Umar Singh, co-founder of the Sikh Coalition. We've had some technological glitches today, but I appreciate you hanging in there, and thank you for taking time, hanging around a building in Washington, D.C. on your cell phone to have a discussion here today on Hearsay Culture. For those who want to learn more about your organization, where can they go?
I just go to our website. It's www.sikhcoalition.org. We have a Sikh Coalition, SIKH Coalition, Facebook page, and we have a Twitter handle, which is SICKSIKH_coalition.
Thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture. This was a great discussion, and I look forward to following your organization's efforts, and certainly on a personal level. It's good to be in touch again, and I commend you for all of the work as that you've been doing. Truly one of the shining examples of CASE alums that are out there today. So thanks for joining us today on the show.
Right back at you, Dave. Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. I'm excited to mention a number of guests coming up on the show. I'm in the process of putting that schedule together, but it's a terrific bunch, and so I'm going to say that at long last, this show, being that it's recorded on October 16th and will air October 17th, you should be able to go to hearsayculture.com and get this quarter's schedule. As always, you have a couple of ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen to the show live this quarter, Wednesdays from 1 to 2 p.m. Pacific time on KZSU FM, or you can stream it live at kzsulive.stanford.edu. You can also get the show via podcast by going to the Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, or by going to our iTunes page, or you can go to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all of the previous shows as well as the upcoming schedule. Again, I appreciate you bearing with me today with some technological glitches, but regardless, I thank you for listening. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.